Alright, so I've been sitting with this idea all week, that the Book of Mormon might be pointing us toward a whole library of ancient texts that most people have never heard of. And that's exactly where Jonah R. Barnes starts in his 2024 book, The Key to the Keystone.
Right, and the title itself is doing a lot of work. The Book of Mormon is famously called the keystone of our religion. So Barnes is asking, what unlocks the keystone? His answer is apocryphal literature. Texts that were hidden, excluded, or simply lost from the standard biblical canon.
Now, for anyone who hasn't encountered that word before, apocrypha, where does it even come from?
It comes from the Greek word apokryphos, meaning hidden or obscure. So these aren't fringe conspiracy texts. They're ancient writings that circulated among early Jewish and Christian communities, but didn't make it into the standard Hebrew Bible or the Protestant Old Testament.
And that's a historically established fact, not Barnes' invention. These texts existed. Scholars study them. The question Barnes is pressing is what they tell us about the world the Book of Mormon came from.
Exactly. Now, the key idea here is the brass plates. The Book of Mormon describes them as containing more scripture than the standard Old Testament, including writings of prophets like Zenos and Zenoch.
And Zenos and Zenoch are fascinating because they're quoted extensively in the Book of Mormon. Allegories, prophecies, real theological weight. But they appear nowhere in the Bible we have today.
Were they real ancient prophets whose writings were lost, or are they a 19th century invention? Barnes's move is to look at the apocryphal record and ask whether any ancient texts preserve traditions that rhyme with what Zenos and Zenoch teach.
Mm-hmm. So not proof, but resonance.
Exactly, and that distinction matters enormously. Think of it this way. If you find an ancient manuscript that describes an olive tree allegory strikingly similar to Zenos's allegory in Jacob chapter 5, that's interesting. It suggests the motif had ancient roots, but it doesn't prove Zenos wrote it or that Joseph Smith didn't compose it independently.
So Barnes is working in what we might call a three-level evidence framework. There's what's historically established, there's Barnes's argument, and then there's what's speculative.
That's a really useful way to hold it. Level A, historically established facts. Ancient apocryphal texts existed and circulated widely. Level B, Barnes's argument. These texts echo or corroborate traditions behind the brass plates. Level C, speculation, that the parallels prove direct continuity or supernatural restoration.
And Barnes is operating mostly at level B, which is legitimate scholarly territory, but it's not the same as level A.
Right. And here's where the Dead Sea Scrolls become relevant. Discovered in 1947, they include pseudepigraphal works, texts written in the name of ancient figures, like the Book of Enoch, these mirror motifs found in Latter-day Saint scripture. But here's the critical point. They were unavailable to the general public in 1830.
Wait, so that's actually a significant data point. If Joseph Smith's revelations align with texts that weren't publicly accessible when he was translating, that's at least worth examining seriously.
Barnes thinks so, and that's the core of his argument in The Key to the Keystone. He's not saying the Apocrypha prove the Book of Mormon. He's saying they expand the plausibility space. They show that the ancient world was far richer, more textually diverse, than the standard Bible alone suggests.
There's also something worth noting about the Bible itself. The original 1611 King James Version actually included the Apocrypha as a separate section between the Old and New Testaments. It was largely removed in the 19th century.
Which means the very Bible most people treat as complete was itself edited down. That's not a conspiracy. It's documented publishing history. And it sets up a question Barnes returns to across all three of his books. What happens when plain and precious things get removed from the record?
That phrase, plain and precious things, comes directly from the Book of Mormon. First Nephi describes things being taken away, or kept back from the Bible, before it reaches the Gentiles.
And Barnes reads that as a theological framework, not just a complaint. If things were lost, they might be recoverable. The Apocrypha become, for him, a kind of archaeological dig site, not scripture, but evidence of what once existed.
So for someone coming to the Key to the Keystone, the takeaway isn't that the Book of Mormon is proven ancient. It's that the ancient world had room for it.
Well put. Barnes is an independent LDS researcher, and these are faith-promoting conclusions, not academic consensus and not official church doctrine. But the intellectual move is serious. Use the apocryphal record to widen our understanding of what ancient Israelite scripture culture looked like.
And that wider picture is exactly what prepares us for his second book. Because if the brass plates represent a fuller record, the next question is, what did that fuller record say about the very beginning? Genesis, Enoch, the flood, Abraham.
That's where the lost gems of Genesis comes in. Barnes moves from the question of what the brass plates contained to the specific narratives Joseph Smith restored or revised, and asks whether ancient texts were already pointing there. That's our next conversation.
So the takeaway from Barnes's first book really is about expanding the plausibility space, not proving the Book of Mormon, but showing the ancient world had room for it.
That's the move, and it's an honest one. He's not claiming the Apocrypha are scripture, he's using them the way an archaeologist uses pottery shards, evidence of a richer culture than the surviving texts alone reveal.
If someone handed you only half a map, you'd still navigate, but you'd miss entire regions. Barnes is arguing the standard Old Testament is that half map.
And the brass plates represent the fuller map. Now, remember, that's Barnes's argument, level B in our framework. The historically established fact is simply that ancient Jewish communities produced far more texts than what survived into the Protestant canon.
Right, and the Dead Sea Scrolls are the clearest proof of that. Discovered in 1947, they showed an entire world of pseudepigraphal literature that mainstream readers had no access to in 1830.
Which is why that date matters so much to Barnes's argument. The resonances between those texts and Joseph Smith's revelations can't easily be explained as borrowing from publicly available sources.
So for someone sitting with all of this, what's the honest bottom line on book one?
Barnes widens the frame. He's not asking listeners to treat apocryphal texts as canon. He's asking them to see that the ancient world was textually diverse enough to make the brass plates historically conceivable. That's a meaningful contribution, even if it stops short of proof.